It's time for phenology. Phenology is the rhythmic, biological nature of events as they relate to climate. One of the events that takes place about this time of year, usually around Christmas time, is the beginning of the chickadees singing their Phoebe song, and that is usually something that, we begin to hear late in December and then moving on to January when we all should hear it. But some of the more intrepid among us and some of the luckier ones have been in the neighborhood of Phoebe singing chickadees, and this is the song. That's our little chickadee singing its Phoebe song, and that's kind of, it's a hormonal reaction to probably increasing day length. Though, before you get too excited, you should know that the day length is not increasing in any great way right now. We have passed the solstice, and so we should be seeing increasing day length, but what happens for about the next 7 to 10 days is that the day length runs, the sunrise will progressively, believe this or not, will progressively get a little bit later. Like, I think it's probably around, I'm sure it's on the device in front of me, and I might be able to dig it out if I got lucky. But anyway, it's probably around 7:50 or 7:51, 7:52, and it will continue to creep forward to about 7:53, 7:54, 7:55. But the day will be holding its own, because each night we will gain about a minute of time. So, for instance, if it's if yesterday on the 21st, or the day before yesterday, Sunday on the 21st, if it were, say, 7:50 to 4:15, tomorrow or today it might be 7:51 or 7:52 to 4:16 or 4:17. And so the sun will continue to rise a bit later, but it will set a bit later each day. So we'll kind of stay about the same number of hours of daylight for the next 7 to about 10 days. And then we'll start to see a little bit of a retreat in the morning hours and a continuing retreat in the evening hours. And by, middle of January, you'll really start to see some significant changes in day length. And by the time we move into February and March, wow, it'll really, really improve. Some of the notes real quickly here that I want to cover that I think are kind of fun and exciting. We had our Christmas bird count on Sunday, and I think Harry and I will probably talk a little bit about that in our Talk on the Wild Side program. But the startling one, I think, was the fact that we found tundra swans on the Mississippi River, or trumpeter swans on the Mississippi River. So you might want to go along the Mississippi River where there's open water in the Cohasset area and look for those. Pretty exciting bird to see. Big flocks of snow buntings are still in the area. I'm seeing a few pine grosbeaks around. The Clearwater Creek up where it crosses County Road 60, which is on my mail route, there are a pair of female mallards that have been staying there for, I'm guessing it's going on 10 days now, and they seem to be doing all right there and kind of hanging out there and feeding and resting, and I don't know, maybe they've decided to make a winter of it right there. We'll have to keep our eye on them and see. And I mentioned last week that there are some first furry buds seen on some pussy willows. This particular patch of pussy willows is aberrant. It's the one group that I see every year that has pussy willows coming out in December. And they'll just stay, these little white furry buds will stay there and just continue to kind of hang out until until probably, March or April, when they'll begin to expand a little bit. But by the end of February, they should be getting joined by lots of other pussy willows in the area. A number of reports came to me over the past week of robins in the area, including Clyde Newton, who lives up on Prairie Lake, and he said that he had a couple that were visiting in his fruit tree. Someone told me they had 8 of them in a fruit tree in their yard, and they wondered about their success, and I thought, well, with 8 of them out looking for food, they might actually survive. I suspect that the robins are a bit like the wild turkeys, and that is, if they have food, they can handle the cold. But we'll see. It's a gamble. These birds are obviously stretching the boundaries a little bit, and perhaps some of them will survive. And if they do, why, they'll certainly have first claim to the territories when spring does come. I've been watching ravens over the past week, and there are smaller flocks of probably unmated adults and juvenile birds, and then there are the pairs that are probably mated pairs, and they usually don't hang out together. And what happens there is that they're kind of, you know, the all eyes are looking for food, and I watched 3 of them crossing a big open area the other day, and they got to the woods on the far side, and all of a sudden one of them kind of pulled up and just sort of soared in a spot for a while, and then the other two came back, and the 3 of them circled and circled and circled, and I thought, well, maybe there's some food down there. But ravens are very cautious about new food sources. If they haven't been there before, they're going to really check it out before they actually come into dine. The other thing I've noticed about ravens in the last week or so that's kind of interesting is those birds that know where they're like roadkill deer, they are excavating holes in that 12, 15, 18 inches of snow to get down to those deer, and they remember perfectly well where those deer are. They have no problem finding the deer, knowing where it is, and digging down with their big beaks. They get in there and they flip the snow out of the way until they're down to that dining opportunity down at the bottom of that snow. So watch for that too, especially if you're driving along and all of a sudden you see a raven sort of appear up out of a snowy ditch. Just try to go back a little bit and think if you can remember whether or not you saw the bird before you got close, because a lot of times they're 12, 15 inches down in a snow hole dining when you see them. We had a report of a Carolina wren this past week from up on Wabana Lake, and there, I know a few years ago, I had seen one at my mother's house, and it was in the winter like this, and I got some really bad pictures of it, but it was undoubtedly a Carolina wren, and every year or every couple of years, it seems like there are a few that show up at the end of the season like this, and why they end up here, I don't know. I was out the other day with all this new snow. I put on my snowshoes and went for a hike, and I was walking around the trails, and I kind of just, you know, crunching along, going pretty steady, and all of a sudden a grouse burst up out of the snow right at the tip of my shoe. It wasn't 8 or 9 inches from the tip of my shoe, and it startled the heck out of me, I'll tell you. And right away I kind of ordered the dog away so that she wouldn't come and stomp on the hole that the grouse had been in, and I checked it out, and inside that hole where the grouse had been roosting, the whole inside of that hole was icy. The bird had been in there a while and had formed this little cavity under the snow, and a little bit of heat had leaked off the bird enough to kind of crystallize the ice, the snow on the inside of that hole. And that bird was probably nice and warm, and here I come stomping along at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and burst it out of there. And I hope that it found another spot just as warm very soon after that. While I was looking at the hole, the dog was kind of running around in the area, and about 30 feet from where this one was, the dog put up another one, and I saw that one fly out of there too. And so 2 of them got rousted out. Well, then I walked a little further around these trails, and I came to a spot where you could see where a grouse had come in for a landing and then gone walking around in the deep snow. And the landing was you know, I guess any landing you walk away from, they say is a good one. This didn't look very graceful. You could see wing marks and feet marks and tail marks as the thing kind of slid across the snow and finally came to rest. But it got itself up and started walking around. And one of the interesting things that happens to grouse in the wintertime is that the sides of their toes grow these little projections. And I suppose science has a name for them, but it escapes me at the moment. But these little projections then act like little, they increase the surface area of the foot, which gives the grouse a little bit of a snowshoe. And so they can walk pretty well in deep snow, although this fluffy light snow that we had on the ground when I was out snowshoeing, the grouse was sinking probably 3 or 4 inches down. So the trail that it was making, the tracks weren't real distinct, but you could see this sort of U-shaped place where the body had kind of dragged through the snow as it walked along. This past week, lots of white-tailed deer out and moving around, and a guy on my mail route says he's feeding deer, and he said that there are still a few bucks coming to his feeder that have their antlers intact. And the final note for this week, and something that you can go out and check out, is about black knot. And black knot is a fungus that usually up here occurs on members of the Prunus species, and in this country that would be the wild plum and the choke cherry and the pin cherry, I believe, are all the Prunus that we have. Wild plum, choke cherry, and pin cherry. So if you see this black crusty looking stuff growing on a branch out there, it's a fungus called black knot, and it is characterized by the presence of a thick, black, irregular swelling on the twigs. The presence of these symptoms is often first noticed in the winter when they are unobscured by leaves. However, the fungal disease-causing agent has been present for quite some time. The pathogen's presence disrupts the normal growth of the twigs, and a tumor-like growth forms at the infection site. Infections may take place as much as a year or more prior to the development of these characteristic knots. Therefore, the swellings are normally not noticed until the winter of the second season of infection. It takes a keen observer to notice the subtle initial symptoms present during the first season of infection. And because this fungal infection kind of is only affecting the Prunus species, and because we don't really live in an area like where Harry came from in Michigan, where they have a lot of Prunus growing, cultivars of Prunus growing, up here it's not such a problem because the plants are generally separated by wide distances, and so the stuff doesn't get around. But here's what happens. The fungus overwinters in the knots. About the time of the bud emergence in the spring, the first ascospores are forcibly discharged from this black fungal structure following a period of warm and wet weather. Apparently, very short periods of wetness, only a few hours, are enough to prompt the discharge. Temperatures between 60 and 80 degrees are ideal for dissemination, germination, and infection of new plant tissue. Recent studies have confirmed and concluded that rainfall and temperature are the key factors in the release of spores, and that the duration of rainfall or wet period is not a factor. The spores are spread widely by air currents and rain splashing. Many succulent green shoots and occasionally wounded tissues are susceptible to infection. The knots develop very slowly, and by the end of the summer will appear as only small galls that might be easily overlooked. If by the second summer, the infection, the knots have enlarged considerably and begin to change to a hard coal black structure. The old knots enlarge each year by advancing at the margins. The fungus mycelium can also spread internally and give rise to new galls some distance from the original knot. Management. Cultural management strategies are important in black knot management. Sites containing Prunus species should be monitored on a regular basis for possible infections. The main strategy to lower disease incidence is the removal of the sources of the spores. All shoots and branches bearing knots should be pruned out during the winter. This pruning should be completed before the spore discharge begins in the spring. Usually that is about the time the buds begin to first break. And so the best thing you can do if you've got some black knot on a spore or on a prunus in your yard is to cut those branches off and either burn, bury, or remove to a dump. Probably burning is the best solution because it's easy and you can just cut them off and throw them in a pile and burn the pile. And so when you see that black knot out there, you know, it's not the end of the world unless you happen to be trying to grow plums in this area. But if you see it and you want to protect the pinch cherries and choke cherries and wild plums in your yard, you might want to cut those branches off and just see that they get burned up. That's the Phenology Show for today. I want to thank you for listening. And as always, if you have observations, comments, or questions you'd like to send along, by all means, get in touch with us. It's time for Talkback. Talkback is your opportunity to communicate with us. Maybe you've seen something out there that you'd like to report on. Maybe you've got a question you'd like to ask. Maybe you just are wanting to communicate with us for one reason or another. It really doesn't matter. We are always waiting to hear from you, and our phone line, our talkback line, is always available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That number is 999-9876. You can call that number and report your observations to us. You can talk about some of the things that you've seen, maybe ask a question if that's in your nature. It doesn't matter what the purpose, we're just waiting to hear from you. And we did hear from our friends down at the Forest View Middle School Bird Club in Baxter, Minnesota. Joey continues to see northern cardinals at the feeder. The pileated woodpecker has been joined by a red-bellied woodpecker. Ben is seeing common redpolls, pine siskins, and two brown creepers in his yard. He watched the two eastern cottontail rabbits fighting and jumping under his feeders in the backyard. He is looking forward to seeing the pine grosbeaks over his break at his grandparents' house in Roseau. Interesting note about the cottontail rabbits. I remember back in 1996 when we had so much snow, I got a note from one of my mother's good friends. She reported that the rabbits were eating out of her bird feeder by walking up to it on the snow. The snow was so deep that winter that the rabbits had no trouble getting to the bird feeder to eat some of the sunflower seeds, and they could do it by just walking up to it. And brown creepers that Ben is noticing, I won't say a common bird, but they're a bird that is here all year round, and they're sort of the anti-nuthatch, I guess, because the brown creepers seem to fly to the bottom of the tree. Their behavior is to come to the bottom of a tree and then work their way up the tree, sort of examining all the little cracks and crevices, looking for little insects that might have secreted themselves away in there. And of course, the nuthatch, his habit is to land on the tree and work his way down the tree from the top down. And I don't know if they're finding things that the other misses because of the angle that they're coming at it from, but it certainly is fun to see them. They have, the brown creepers, that is, have a little bit of a decurved beak. It curves slightly down, and it's a long, thin beak. The bird is about the size of a red-breasted nuthatch, not quite as big as a white-breasted nuthatch. And as its name implies, it is kind of a nondescript brown bird. But lovely to see. And, you know, you just never know. You could be looking outside your door this morning and find one. To continue, Nate is still looking for Canada geese heading south, and he heard some birds chirping but did not see them. I suspect, down in the Brainerd area, the Mississippi River stays open there in town, and they get a lot of waterfowl in that area. And I suspect that there are probably some Canada geese who have elected to stay the winter in that area. And I have the same sort of thing going on up here. We have some Canada geese in this area that are staying on the river, and I doubt that there will be any more flocks of Canada geese heading south unless things turn really cold. Logan has been watching white-breasted nuthatches stealing peanuts from each other. One will hide the peanut from his feeder in the bark of a tree, and another nuthatch will fly over and steal it. This behavior seems to be sort of, I won't say universal, but it certainly is something that's been observed in ravens as well. And the raven, or in this case the nuthatch, will try to secrete a bit of food and cache it and maybe hold on to it and keep it for use later or for eating later. And what happens is the other birds are watching just as carefully as you might expect. And when that first bird who's stolen off with this piece of food hides it, another bird will say, well, you know, the tyranny at the feeder is not worth the effort. I could go over there and steal that piece and probably get away with it, and they will. And in the case of ravens, the ravens will oftentimes make a steady defense of their cached food in order to keep other ravens from getting it. But it's one of those games where, you know, the longer and harder you work to defend that piece of cached food, the less time you can spend at the feeder where you got the food to begin with. Wyatt and Travis report the four thistle feeders at their home were busy with American goldfinches and house finches when they were home for those two late start mornings this past week. It also appears the northern cardinal and red-bellied woodpecker are becoming winter residents in their yard. A flock of European starlings have also found their feeders. Sam saw some very large sundogs in the sky Monday morning. He also heard trees popping, saw a large flock of snow buntings, found a lot of mouse tracks in the snow, saw tracks on the lakes, and a raccoon ran out of a brush pile his father was burning. I've kind of gotten away from burning brush piles for that reason and others. They become, you know, homes to a lot of critters, and I just try to make them in areas around my property where they're not going to be a problem. So I'll pile up the brush, and usually I start with some logs or a stump or something at the bottom to give it a little bit of a hollow spot, and then I just pile on the brush, and it's amazing who will find that place a comfortable home for the winter. The raccoons, for the most part, this time of year would be preferring to probably sleep for a while. They don't hibernate, but they do sleep for long periods of time, especially when it's cold. And it's been cold, so I would think that that's probably the behavior. Finally, Mr. Perry reports the mourning dove and fox sparrows are still coming to his feeder. He is looking forward to participating in three of the local Christmas bird counts. Well, that's our report for this week. Have a happy holiday, and we hope to see you outside. That from the Forest View Middle School Bird Club in Baxter, Minnesota. Mr. Perry is the teacher there. Our own Christmas bird count took place this past weekend. On Sunday, we were out stomping around in the woods. Maybe you saw a car full of people with binoculars staring at your bird feeders, and you were curious about that. We talked to a number of folks, and everybody, it seems, are fairly interested when you tell them that you're part of a group that are out counting birds for the Audubon Society and the Christmas bird count. It's quite exciting. Our count here was not as successful as last year, at least hadn't been at noon on Sunday when we last talked, but it was a pretty good count, and I know that our good friend and great birder Sean Conrad had found a number of waterfowl along the Mississippi River, including, he said, 8 tundra swans who have decided to spend the winter in the area. So if you're lucky enough to be along the Mississippi River in the Cohasset area, you might want to kind of keep an eye out for those very large white birds, and they will be pretty visible when they come along. So we will have complete news about our Christmas bird count coming up in the next week or so once the data is all collected and collated, and we'll talk to you about that when the time comes. It's time for a talk on the wild side.
All right.
And you and I are going to talk a little bit about a couple of things that, well, we had our Christmas bird count this weekend, Sunday.
Yeah, and real quick, John, you know, did you get your Christmas shopping done?
No, I'm going to do that today before I go curling, and I'll do it tomorrow after I get done with the mail route about 5 o'clock. So, yeah.
So you got a little bit of scotch in you.
It's brandy, actually, but okay. Same kind of thing.
Well, I was
thinking,
isn't curling kind of a Scottish thing? You'd have to be drunk to wait this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, curling is definitely a Scottish game.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Anyways, and for those people who have procrastinated like John and I, you know, you could look at, you know, one of the things I like to do for colleagues or folks that I'm scrounging around trying to think of something to do, especially with the increased prices in some of the seed that people are noticing, boy, this is a great year to attract red poles. In fact, on this Christmas bird count, we got goldfinches, and just Sue and I, my wife and I, got goldfinches, pine siskins, and red poles. So they're all in the area, and plus more finches, like you mentioned, pine grosbeaks, the bigger ones. But if you want to get a bag of a thistle seed or something for them, Niger seed, it's also called, and a little tube feeder at one of your local bird feeding stores that you like to attend and see what they have, some of the new feeders, that's not much, and that'll provide. Or if you have a shut-in that you like to maybe provide some entertainment and some activity for in the winter, so they can look out their window, and that's another thing. I think a good gift is a tube feeder and or a little bit of Niger seed.
Yeah, you know, my daughter bought me one of those a couple of years ago for Christmas, and I put it up, and I've had mixed success. Right now, I have pine siskins dining there, but not a big flock, and they're pretty, you know, it takes them several days to empty it, so
yeah.
I just don't have that, you know, like some years you'll get 30 or so siskins or red poles or goldfinches, and the thing just disappears.
I mean,
you get this. What amazes me about the thistle feeder is that you look at the snow.
Wait a minute, now, John. The reason for this is you cut down all your birch trees. You hate them so much.
I haven't cut them all down.
Okay.
I still have. I still have one or two, but the debris underneath the thistle feeder looks like they're spilling the seeds, but if you start looking at those things, it just hulls, and it's pretty amazing how well they perform that little task.
And they pull them out of these little holes in those two feeders.
Yeah. See, if you got this as a gift for someone or as a gift yourself, how long would you expect it to take for the birds to find it? I mean, how long can you kind of, is there a point at which you should say, whoa, man, I guess there's just not any birds in this neighborhood, or?
Well, you know, I think it's, from the research that's been done, it's these birds are attuned to the nuthatches, chickadees, woodpeckers, and that are traditionally around your feeder. If they pick that up, and if you're feeding some of these other birds that are typically in your neighborhood, if you're spending some time and money putting some seed out for them, then I think they hear these chickadees and nuthatches and woodpeckers, and these other birds come and see what's out there. And then, of course, if you know, the neat thing about thistle seed to me is that the squirrels don't like it.
Yeah.
And you can
and they
even
can't
put
figure
that,
out how to get it out of the
you
feeder.
You can even put that on an open tray feeder.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And then you get the big flocks.
Wow.
The big congregations, because of those tube feeders, of course.
Yeah, there's only 8 perches on mine.
You can get those. You can buy those little screen feeders, and the thistle seed doesn't go out of that. There's usually two screens.
I haven't seen those.
Yeah, and they're big trays, and you just hang them off of a wire or a tree.
Oh, okay.
Well, the squirrels won't bother with this thistle seed, which is good because it's more expensive.
It is.
And but the little finches love it. So that's my advice to you.
Nice.
That's what we do, and that's how we get the big flocks is because if you got that tray feeder, you know, they big bunches of them can come in. If you got a tube feeder, you can get, you know, 4 to 6 on there at a time. And,
yeah.
And the other ones are sitting there going, well, I'm going to go look somewhere else because these other guys are hogging, you know. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's a great gift and a great idea for folks that might want to...
One other quick note, and then I want to get to red-belly woodpeckers.
Okay, well, you give that quick note, and then I'm going to interrupt for a minute to tell people what they're doing and why they should be careful, and then we'll get back to the red-bellied woodpecker. What's your note?
I just noticed on the internet I got a little note that says if you're looking for the new Minnesota Tree and Shrub Guide by Welby Smith, who wrote the orchid one, 30% off.
Really?
I just got an email for that. So
dang. And that's on my, that's a big one on my Christmas list. So. That's kind of highlighted and written in red and underlined a few times. So I'm kind of hoping that that one shows up at my house because I'm excited to see that.
University of Minnesota bookstore sent a note about that.
All right. Well, let me tell you that you're listening to KAXE, and the voice you just heard belongs to Harry Hutchins. Harry's an instructor at Itasca Community College. And he shows up here every Tuesday morning for a program we call A Talk on the Wild Side. In the weather for our area, there is a winter weather advisory that remains in effect until 3 p.m. this afternoon. The total snow accumulations of 3 to 5 inches are expected by mid-afternoon across the region, with the highest amounts along and south of U.S. Highway 2 from Leech Lake to Grand Rapids and Duluth, over into Wisconsin down by Ashland. Some locales from the Brainerd Lakes region eastward to Hinckley and Hayward may see accumulations up to 6 inches. While the snow will remain light for much of the day, it will become moderate to locally heavy for several hours late this morning and early this afternoon. The snow will gradually diminish to flurries or light snow showers after midnight tonight. So that's kind of the situation out there. Temperatures are in the low to mid single digits, and humidity is about 88 to 90%. Not that that matters too much. And the wind is very light right now around the area, ranging from about 5 miles per hour to zero. And east, southeast, appears to be the major direction from all of the reporting weather stations. So that's the weather. And now, Harry, you mentioned that you wanted to talk a little bit about red-bellied woodpeckers.
Yeah, we got this mid-size, pretty robust...
baby pileated.
Yeah, baby, with a ladder back, and it's just a zebra back, whatever you want to call it. And a really neat woodpecker with the orangish-red head, or at least the back of the head is that way. It doesn't cover the entire head.
Right. And some people have mistakenly identified it as a red-headed woodpecker because it has a red head.
And if you look under the belly, right by where the feet come out, there is a red patch there, an orangish patch.
I have not noticed that.
Oh, that's where it got its name.
Yeah, well, I was wondering because I'll tell you what, that is one of the least distinct markings on that bird. Well, it has a lot of other markings that really jump out at you, but that's not one of them.
We've had one coming to a feeder all year long, and so we've gotten some great looks at that.
So you didn't have to shoot one? And,
No.
Oh, good. Well, that's nice.
The neat thing, John, is I talked to the couple that keeps track of the birds that are coming in of the Christmas bird count and coordinating it, and we got, I think, 5 or 6 in the Grand Rapids count. Now, keep in mind that this bird was only in Houston County in 1960. This
really?
Range, this
now,
bird.
Houston, before you go any further, Houston County is the most southeastern county in the state of Minnesota.
It's that's got
the
hardwood one, trees.
That's the one way down in the corner.
Yeah.
The southeast corner of the state. Okay.
Yeah. And kind of Iowa, Wisconsin stuff.
Yep.
And so this bird, since 1960, has been moving up steadily in the state. And there's some neat range maps that have been made for this. And by about 1975... you start to see it just north of the Twin Cities. And then around 1995 is where we first started getting it just south of Duluth and Carlton County and on over to maybe Southern Cass and Crow Wing County, think places like that. And then finally by about 2000, is when we started to get regular sightings of them here, getting close to the 46, 47 degrees north latitude. So this is a pretty recent stuff. This is more like cardinals. And as the climate changes, this is one of those birds that's shifting up north, and it prefers, of course, in the past, it's preferred lowland hardwoods. Now we're starting to see it more in urban areas, urban woodlots, as well as, sometimes even pine forests. But it's kind of becoming more of a generalist habitat-wise.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Sibley Field Guide to Birds of Eastern North America, published in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And they show the map for the red-bellied woodpecker as cutting across the state just about even with the North Dakota-South Dakota border, so about the southern half of the state.
Oh.
And then in the northern half of the state, they have it shown as rare. But it's becoming much, much more common. And that's, if this book were published in 2003, the data was probably collected in 2000 or 2001, maybe 2002 even. But that's, the map data is what I'm talking about. So it just in the last few years, they've become much more common.
And we're in town in Grand Rapids. We have it coming to our suet cake. And you can really, you can really see the orange patch when you have a suet cake pretty close and at the bottom there, and where
yeah.
it got its name, the red
right,
belly.
Right.
And where I got this range map is this National Geographic Complete Birds of North America.
I see that.
And it's... anyways,
that's not your field guide book, that
this
one.
This is not. This is more a little bit of natural history of every bird in the United States.
Yeah, that's a beauty. That's a lovely book. And, we were talking earlier about feeders and thistle feeding as a gift idea, and that would make a great gift for people who really like to study the birds. And it has a lot more detail about each species, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And
yeah.
It's published by National
Geographic. Yeah.
And it's called what? Birds?
Complete Birds of North America.
Yeah.
And it says it's a companion to the National Geographic Field Guide to the Birds. This is edited by Jonathan Aldifer.
So, Aldifer.
Yeah, not to be confused with the woody plants, alder, or fir.
Right.
But this is F-E-R.
Yeah.
Although sometimes, as I notice grading my test, my students spell it subalpine or balsam fir, and they spell it F-U-R. So you never know. It passes the spell checker, I think.
Oh, yeah, sure it does. Yeah, well, there's a lot of those that make the grade but don't. Well, Harry, you've got a couple of minutes here. Let's see. Oh, you've got 45 seconds. When I look at that clock, I can't see the hands very well, and I always think I have more time than I do. But I look at this clock, and I see that we're almost out of time. So real quickly, what is it that you want for Christmas that you probably are not going to get?
Oh, that I'm probably not going to get.
The 42-inch flat panel TV?
Yeah. Well, I still have that old 19-incher, and I must say that to watch hockey night in Canada or something. Those guys are pretty small, and the puck, you can't really see that puck. So maybe, yeah, that would be a good
one. Yeah, that would be a nice one.
Anything. I'm pretty easy. You get me a nice field guide here or there, something I still need to learn about.
Yeah, well, John, or Welby Smith's book on Trees and Shrubs in Minnesota would be a great gift for anybody.
It would.
Who aspires to be a naturalist in Minnesota.
And Michigan Trees is a good one, too.
All right. Well, Harry, thanks very much for joining me all these years. Have a Merry Christmas.
Oh, yeah, and we'll see you probably closer to New Year's.
Well, it's my pleasure to introduce Tom Dixon to KAXE listeners. Tom has produced a beautiful new book, beautiful to look at, great reading. It features profiles about 105 fish in the waters of Minnesota. Many of them you will be familiar with, like the walleyes, the muskies, the northerns, the smallmouth and largemouth bass. You'll also learn a lot of new things about those species we think we know a lot about. And you'll learn about a whole bunch of fish, including very small minnows and darters, that we may never see here in northern Minnesota because they inhabit waters in the southern, southeastern, and southwestern parts of the state. Tom Dixon is on the line with us this morning. Tom, are we talking to you in Montana?
You are, Scott, yeah.
So how did we lose a Minnesota boy like you to Montana? I got a hunch it might have something to do with trout fishing.
Well, partly it had to do with that. It also had to do with my wife wanted to move to Montana. So I was working for the Minnesota DNR in St. Paul, and I was really happy there. And but she wanted to move out west, so we came out west about 7 years ago. And but I've kept my finger in Montana or in Minnesota. I continue to go back there every year and fish, and I also continue to write for the Minnesota Conservation Volunteer, which is a magazine a lot of your listeners will be familiar with, published by the Minnesota DNR.
Well, the Great Minnesota Fish Book by you and is a great Minnesota fish book. And tell us first, before we talk about some of the fish, tell us about the illustrator, Joseph Tomilleri.
Yeah, that's the pronunciation, Scott. We're really lucky to have him illustrate the book. He's the preeminent fish illustrator in North America. There's no one like him. And what's unique about Joseph is he's also a biologist, and so he's this extraordinarily gifted fish illustrator, and he's also a fisheries biologist, and so he has the technical and the artistic expertise, and there's no one like him. And Audubon magazine called him the John James Audubon of the fish world, and that's really true. I mean, there's just, people look at those illustrations and their jaws just drop because they cannot believe how perfectly he depicts a walleye or a smallmouth bass or a northern pike or, like you said, some of these smaller fish like the dace and the shiners and the sculpins.
Well, it's true. I'm looking at the freshwater drum right now, a fish I've never caught, but I wanted to start with the freshwater drum. And tell us about this fish.
Well, that's a fish that's found throughout Minnesota, and you find it in rivers and lakes in northern Minnesota. It's a lot of people catch them and think they're a sucker. They have kind of a lipped mouth, but they're not a sucker at all. They're related to the saltwater drums, like the redfish of the Gulf of Mexico. In fact, the famous dish from New Orleans, blackened redfish, that saltwater fish looks almost identical to the freshwater drum in Minnesota. And it's just an amazing fish. For one thing, the most amazing thing is how great it tastes. And a lot of times I'll see anglers, you know, they'll catch a freshwater drum, nice 5-pound drum, and, you know, throw it up on the bank, and then they'll be all happy because they catch a 14-inch or walleye. And the drum honestly tastes exactly the same as a walleye. I've done taste tests. I've fried them up side by side and had friends over for dinner and said, which one's the walleye and which one's the drum? The drum's also known in Minnesota as the sheep's head, and people can't tell the difference. So it's a great food fish, and it's a cool fish. It's beautiful to look at. It's real easy to catch. People pick them up a lot in smallmouth bass waters because they like kind of those, especially in rivers, they like those shallow riffles where smallmouth bass hang out.
Mm-hmm. And they can get, the drum can get to be pretty big, can't they?
Well, they down in southern Minnesota where it's a little warmer, in the Mississippi River, they can get to be 30 or 40 pounds. And so they're a big-sized fish. Mm-hmm. And northern waters, they don't get much bigger than 10 or 15 pounds.
Well, you know, you're talking to us while we are in northern Minnesota, from Brainerd up to Ely and Bemidji over to Cloquet and Aiken. And would we see a lot of drum in our waters?
Would see drum. They have the widest distribution from north to south of any fish in North America. So they're found all the way up into northern Manitoba, as far north as that, and then as far south as the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. So people do pick them up in northern Minnesota, and like I said, they usually think that they're a sucker, but they do catch them. And there's a number of lakes in the northern part of the state where you can find them, and also they're in the Mississippi River and some of the major river systems up there.
Well, I thought I knew a lot about fish, but even the fish I thought I knew stuff about, I learned new things from your text. And one thing I was surprised to learn was that a smallmouth bass is not native to a lot of our lake waters, is it?
Isn't that interesting? I got to say that the book is filled with surprises like that. And I worked for the Minnesota DNR for 14 years, and before that I worked for Fins and Feathers magazine. So I've been writing about fish for, 25 years. And I can't tell you how many amazing things I found in that book, and that's kind of why I wrote it, because I just thought, geez Louise, so many other anglers and people interested in Minnesota's natural history will want to know this too. And one of them is, smallmouth bass, you think of it as indigenous to the boundary waters or to canoe country as like a Duluth pack.
Right.
In fact, those fish are not native. They're native to northern Minnesota, but they're only native to the Mississippi River watershed. And so those border lakes, those smallmouth bass up there were originally stocked by anglers and by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and then later by the Minnesota DNR. And they did really well in there. They haven't needed to be stocked for decades. And those fish are really a part of the Northwoods culture up there.
Yeah, I can remember in the 1950s, late 50s and 60s, my brother and dad and I, we go up to the boundary waters because my dad wanted to do some great smallmouth bass fishing, and here I learned that they weren't even native to that water.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, Tom, I got to ask you: do you have a favorite species or group of fish to fish for?
Oh, I tell you, I'm really partial to the channel catfish, and for a couple of reasons. One is they're so beautiful. I think catfish are a really beautiful fish. They're a great food fish, and the channel catfish especially is it's super strong. They've got this deeply forked tail, which adds to their power. But, channel catfish, a 2 or 3 pound channel catfish is a really powerful fish, so it's a fun fish to catch. And one of the things that I find so surprising about the channel cat is that one of the best channel catfish fisheries in North America is over there on the Red River of the North. And, that's a river that runs eventually into Hudson Bay, a north flowing river. That's so weird, because you think of channel catfish is this southern fish, Alabama and Oklahoma, and there's anglers from those states, from all over the South, who drive up. They drive right past Brainerd, they drive right past Mille Lacs, they drive right past Leech Lake. They're heading to, Fargo-Moorhead. They're going to fish the Red River of the North. And so you drive by there in the summer, and there's all these license plates from Missouri and Iowa and Alabama, and you think, what the heck? And those guys are after those trophy channel catfish on the Red River. I just think that's a kind of a cool feature about that fish, that's one of the premier channel catfish destinations in North America.
Yeah, I didn't know that at all until I read this. And they, of course, can get pretty big, too, into the 30-pounder.
Yeah, they can be really big. They can get up to 40, 50 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Is there, I like to eat the smaller fish. Even a small 3/4 pound bass tastes delicious to me. And the panfish are good eating, and the smaller walleyes and northerns are among my favorite fish to eat. Is it true with, I've never, like I said, I hadn't caught the drum, and I haven't caught a lot of bullheads, which don't get that big anyway, but a channel catfish and a drum that can get to be in the 30-pound range, are the smaller fish better tasting, or is it?
Yeah, that's exactly true. They're better tasting.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's pretty much true for most fish. There's a line between, the smaller fish are better tasting. For one thing, they have less time to what's called bioaccumulate, which is when they're eating aquatic insects or other fish, any sort of toxins or any kind of, bad-tasting things that are in the water accumulate in those larger predator fish. And so when they get to be really old, like a walleye that's 10 or 15 years old, that fish just doesn't taste nearly as good as a 4 or 5 pound walleye. But there's a trade-off there, like a small northern pike, anglers call them hammer handles, you know, let's say 18-inch northern pike. It's a really good fish to eat, but you've got to fillet out the Y bones, and so there's a lot of bother there, and it's the same bother you would have with a 24-inch northern pike, and so you get, you know, three or four times as much meat. So there's kind of a trade-off between the smaller fish are generally better to eat, but you don't get a lot of meat off them. So most anglers, you know, are pretty happy to catch a, you know, kind of a mid-sized fish. Like, you know, the perfect eating walleye is about 18 inches.
Mm-hmm.
And so a northern pike, you know, a good northern pike is, you know, usually from 2 feet to 3 feet long.
Yeah.
You know, those are nice eating size northerns.
I've got to ask you about the whitefish, which when the first Europeans arrived here, well, they just had high hopes for it. I like the social history surrounding the whitefish, too. Tell us about that.
Well, what's interesting is you know, people are crazy about walleyes in Minnesota. I mean, that's just a given. But originally, when Europeans first came to this region, what they were most excited about was the lake whitefish. And the lake whitefish is a fish that's found throughout northern Minnesota, and it's a salmonid. It's related to trout and salmon. And the lake whitefish is also closely related to the cisco, which in northern Minnesota is also known as the tulipy. So those two fish are closely related. They're almost identical. And so anyway, lake whitefish, they have this great meat, this rich, red, delicious meat. And that's what Europeans were crazy about, these whitefish. And so that's all they could think about. And the very first Minnesota Fish Commission reports in the late 1870s, that's all they would talk about. You know, they didn't even mention walleyes. It was just all about lake whitefish and the commercial opportunities for lake whitefish, and there was already a lot of commercial fishing activity in northern Minnesota, and mainly that was targeting lake whitefish because the meat was so delectable. It was sold fresh in meat markets. It was smoked and sold down in the Twin Cities in meat markets and then shipped, you know, to Chicago and Denver and places like that. So people really thought they'd hit the sort of the lake whitefish mother lode when they moved to Minnesota.
And how are the lake whitefish populations now? Especially, I'm thinking of the Lake Superior. Did the numbers or the populations go way down because we overfished it? Or
yeah, they did. They went down due to overfishing, and then they were also affected by the sea lamprey, which invaded Lake Superior and really decimated the lake trout population, especially. But also the lake whitefish population, as well as the cisco population. In Lake Superior, they call ciscos lake herring. Mm-hmm. They're not a herring, but that's what they call them. And so all those salmonids, those native salmonids, lake trout, whitefish, and herring, they all crashed, you know, in the 50s and 60s. What happened is the U.S. Fish Wildlife Service and the states, Wisconsin and Minnesota DNR, have been applying this chemical to tributary streams that kill the young sea lamprey, and so those lamprey numbers are down to about 10% of what they were in the 50s, and so that's allowed the lake trout population and the whitefish and cisco populations to rebound. And now those populations, interestingly, are really strong. They're even considering now allowing some limited commercial fishing for lake trout on Lake Superior, which they haven't allowed for 20 years.
Yeah.
So that's a real great sign that Lake Superior is really back in action, and it's doing fantastic right now.
You know, I didn't know this either. The state record for the lake whitefish is 12 pounds, 4.5 ounces, caught in Leech Lake.
Caught in Leech Lake, yeah.
Right in our listening area here.
Yeah, it's got Leech Lake has got a really nice lake whitefish population. And one interesting thing about whitefish and tulipies, also known as cisco, is that when lakes, those big musky and northern pike and walleye lakes, when they have whitefish or tulipy in them, that's what creates a giant trophy predator fish, because those lake whitefish and the tulipy, they're a real fatty fish, and they're like a double cheeseburger with fins for those big muskies and walleyes. They can really put on the pounds, kind of like a linebacker, you know, at Hardee's. You know, they can just, you know, really get big, and that's why some lakes have really big northerns and walleyes and muskies, and other lakes don't. One of the reasons is because those lakes that don't have those big predator fish don't have the whitefish and don't have the tulipies.
Uh-huh. Now, this time of year, another interesting thing I learned about the cisco, are they spawning right now?
Yeah, they spawn. They're the last fish to spawn in the year, and they come into shallow water in late November and December, and they spawn over rocky shoals. And traditionally, people have netted them in the winter through the ice, actually, or just before ice up, they'll go out and net Ciscos. And that, for a long time, that was a big tradition in northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin, the sort of netting of Ciscos in late season. A lot of guys during deer camp, you know, would go out and do a little netting during the day, you know, to kind of break up the tedium. So they're the last fish to spawn, and then the first fish to spawn each year is the what's known as the eel pout, also sort of officially known as the, what's the name for the eel pout? But anyway, your listeners will be familiar with the eel pout, and that's a fish that actually spawns...
A burbot.
Burbot, right, and spawns in late January and early February. And so those two fish, the whitefish and then the burbot, they're kind of the bookends of the spawning season. Most fish spawn in April, May, and June.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we have the eel pout festival in Walker every February.
Oh, yeah. Now that's becoming a sort of internationally known event. I have kind of mixed feelings about that because, on one hand, it really does celebrate the eel pout and known as the burbot. But on the other hand, it kind of, I don't know, denigrates the fish. You know, there people fish through toilet bowls and stuff, and it's kind of fun and stuff. But the burbot is a really cool fish, and what's amazing is that only in Minnesota is it really held in disdain, because like here in Montana, it's a widely caught food fish. Alaska has a daily limit of 2 burbot per day. Idaho, numbers are so low in Idaho that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has actually been raising eel pout in a hatchery and releasing them in rivers in Idaho. So they're actually stocking eel pout in Idaho. So it's a fantastic fish. It's a great food fish. It's just a cool fish. It's the only freshwater member of the cod family.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just there's so many neat things about it. But, boy, Minnesotans, when I grew up, you know, fishing Mille Lacs and lakes like that, boy, you know, you never kept an eel pout. You just throw them out the fish house.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a shame because they've got some really great meat on them. And I remember, you know, my uncle getting all excited. He caught a one-pound walleye. Well, we had, like, 20 pounds of eel pout out on the ice that were just, you know, going to be left for the gulls. And he was getting all excited about this 15-inch walleye he caught. So it never made sense to me. And when I started to research the book, it made even less sense.
We're talking with Tom Dixon. He's the author of The Great Minnesota Fish Book with beautiful illustrations by Joseph Tomilleri. Tom, I think let's close about talking about something you just mentioned, and you've mentioned a few times now, and that is some of our biases. Now, I got to admit, I have a bias toward something we call rough fish, which is just that term alone describes our bias, I think, the carp and the other rough fish. But how do you think we got these biases?
Well, I don't know, Scott. It's an odd thing, but in every culture, there's sort of the fish that people like to disdain, and I don't think it's any more true than in Minnesota, which is such a fish-crazy state, but there's a real hierarchy of fish, and there's the great fish, the muskies and the walleyes and the crappies, and then there's the sort of the bottom of the ranking, which is the carp and the suckers. And, you know, people just say the name carp and sucker with such disdain in their voices. But, you know, those fish are cool fish. The carp, for example, is the most widely eaten freshwater fish in the world. It's the top sport fish in Europe. In England, they're absolutely bonkers. They're crazier about carp fishing in England than Minnesotans are about walleye fishing in Minnesota. I mean, honestly, I've been to England. I fish in England. And there's nothing to compare it to. And, you know, carp are this amazing fish. They're beautiful. They're super smart. And they're so strong. Suckers are a native species in Minnesota. They're you know, indigenous to lakes and streams all over northern Minnesota. They're part of the ecosystem. Freshwater drum we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what happened is at the turn of the 20th century, our waters got so polluted from sort of industrial and logging effluent that the native fish died out. But a few other species that were non-native, like carp, that were imported to Minnesota, they thrived. They can survive in almost anything. And so I think people actually thought the carp were responsible for declines in walleye populations, and they blamed the carp of all things. So I think that bias has stuck for decades. And you still see it. Geez, when I worked for the DNR, you know, people would call and complain about carp, and they caught a carp. Or every time I'd go fishing on a river, I'd see carp thrown up on the bank. It was crazy. And I'd talk to anglers and say, you know, there's no reason to throw these on the bank. Just put them back in the water or take them home and eat them. They're a great food fish.
Yeah.
It's always puzzled me.
Well, you sure tapped into my prejudices as I was reading this. I have a whole new way of looking at most of these species. We didn't even get to the tiniest of the fish, but they're all there, the darters and the daces. And the other thing I want you to mention is the different watersheds and how they will define, in many cases, what species live where.
Well, that's an interesting thing that people don't understand. Why are fish in one part of the state and not in the other part? But Minnesota has 8 different watersheds, and these are sort of major basins of the state, major landscapes that drain into certain directions, like the Lake Superior watershed. Those are the rivers like the St. Louis and the Temperance that drain into the Lake Superior. And then there's the Rainy River Basin, and that drains all into the Rainy River. Then there's the Red River Basin. That's a really big one, and that's the biggest one in your region. And that all those streams and lakes drain into the Red River. And so fish don't go, you know, we're never able to travel from one major watershed to another because, you know, there's a little higher part of land that never allowed that stream to get from one to the other. So that's why you have, you know, fish like in the Red River Basin, you've got channel catfish, and you don't have channel catfish over in the Lake Superior Basin. It's not that far away.
Mm-hmm. Tom, great book. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Scott. I'd be happy to talk to you anytime. Maybe we can talk next year during the fishing opener. That's a fun time to talk about those small fish.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
That's Tom Dixon. His book is The Great Minnesota Fish Book. And if you want more information about it, call KAXE. Thanks, Tom.
All righty. Thanks, Scott.
Bye-bye.
Bye.